Good morning. You're tuned in to Listen Local, brought to you by your neighborhood news source, Mission Local, via BFF.fm. Today, we're going to join the rest of the city in talking about that ever contentious and ever complicated topic, immigration. Joining us today to talk about immigration policy at the local level and in a broader context is Suzanne Jonas. Since the 1990s, Suzanne has been a specialist on Guatemalan and Central American migration. She also taught at UC Santa Cruz for more than 20 years and has worked extensively with community organizations. Together with Nestor Rodriguez, she recently published a book called Guatemala-U.S. Migration, Transforming Regions. The book includes a case study chapter on the conditions faced by Guatemalan and other low-wage Latino migrant communities in the San Francisco area. Suzanne will be at Modern Times Bookstore tonight to give a talk on her book and to discuss immigration policy. She agreed to sit down with us as well. Suzanne, thank you very much for joining me today. Very much appreciated that you could take the time to be with us.
My pleasure. I'm glad to do it.
Great. So, first, let's start with your connection to the Mission District. I think you had mentioned that you used to live in the area for quite some time. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I lived in the heart of the Mission District for almost 20 years. And when I say in the heart of the Mission District, I mean right along 24th Street, which I consider the inner Mission District. And in fact, that's the core of the Mission District. And I was a renter in a building of 7 apartments, and I was the only non-Latino tenant in the building. A lot of my interest in doing this, as well as the actual content of the chapter, was sparked by my own experiences living there and watching things change, although the big changes and the real gentrification happened after I left, which was in 2001, when I moved out of that apartment that I had.
Mm-hmm. So what were you seeing around you? Describe your neighborhood at that time. What do you remember?
Well, it was a working class neighborhood. The rents were under market prices, actually, at that time, because it was so totally Latino. And the real gentrification had not started as of the time that I left in 2001. But it was in the years since then that I've begun to see, you know, changes in the population of the Mission District, and particularly the inner Mission District, and the also 24th Street. The businesses are changing tremendously, and I write a lot about what used to be in certain spots and what's there now. So it's been, because pretty much all of the businesses were Latino-owned, and that has changed quite a bit. Others have adapted. La Victoria is still in the hands of the same people, but they catered to two different clientels. They catered to the Latina women who come in to buy pan dulce, and they also catered to the new crowd who want cupcakes.
Yeah, absolutely. In one of your pieces, you write that some areas in the Inner Mission District showed signs of economic deterioration, overcrowded housing, crime, and gangs. It was largely a barrio of the working poor, but it was their Latino space. But in the early 21st century, with San Francisco in flux, this relative stability has been shattered. Tell me about that stability and how it affects people's lives for it to be shattered in a way that, you know, many people say has reduced the amount of crime.
Well, let me start by saying that I actually, when I saw your question about the crime rate, it's a very mixed bag. Some crimes have gone up, other crimes have gone down. So I believe prostitution and some other crimes have gone down, but burglary has gone up.
Yeah, and I have to qualify that question by saying, of course, you know, we just wrote an article a few days ago about two different shootings happening the same night in the Mission District. So certainly it's hard to claim that crime has been eradicated right. or that gentrification has you know, stabilized crime completely. But it is one of the things that people like to say about gentrification. Oh, it's not so bad because, you know, at least crime has gone down, gang activity has been reduced. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that that's what some people like to think. I don't know that it's become a better neighborhood for having been displaced, so many Latinos. And in that regard, I think it's important to note that whereas before 2000, the relative percentage of Latinos in the Mission District and in the Inner Mission District, which is more the area, the lower Mission and the area around 24th and Mission and so on, was stable in terms of the percentage of Latino population. But in the period between 2000 and 2010, according to census data, all of those percentages went down by at least 10%, meaning that there's a whole phenomenon going on of displacement. People cannot afford to stay here anymore, and they're having to move to Oakland or farther east. So that is definitely a downside of because these are people who have been here for decades, many of them.
What about for immigrants who are newly arriving? I think you've mentioned also that they have a tendency to now arrive and settle more in the East Bay and in, not so much in San Francisco anymore. But clearly we still have immigrants who arrive here. And what do you think it's like for them to come into this space that's now in such flux?
Well, you know, the whole question of immigrant and arrival, which is actually the focus of the book that I co-authored with. And I think one of the things that has affected immigrants in particular is that if the families that they come to join aren't here anymore, they don't have a place to go and get a space to stay, tips on getting jobs. There was a whole culture of that. And that to the extent that the family members have moved to Oakland, the newly arriving immigrants will have to go other places than San Francisco. And I think also the word gets out by the networks of immigrants that, you know, San Francisco is not a place that you can afford to settle. So I think there's many different ways and reasons why there's less. San Francisco isn't the first stop, whereas in the 80s and the 90s, especially for refugees and immigrants coming from El Salvador and Guatemala, it was a natural place to come because San Francisco is historically open to cultural diversity. And the mark that these movements from Central America have made on the city is just tremendous. But when the reality of real estate is taken into account, then things begin to change. So San Francisco, and particularly the Mission District, which has been the most affected in the last 10 years by gentrification because it hadn't happened sooner, are no longer viable options. And so one of the things the mayor likes to say, and some other officials, that San Francisco is a model for immigration policies that are immigrant-friendly. And, well, I think that's largely, it's true certainly on the in the terms of diversity, openness to diversity and cultural, cultural diversity. And it was also true in terms of San Francisco being a sanctuary city. But those things have been altered And, you know, there when there's a decreasing number of immigrants who benefit, then you can have the best policies in the world and still not benefit as many people. And there are some statistics on that, actually, that show that San Francisco has been able to benefit less people than some of the surrounding counties, which is where the immigrants are going now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to talk more about sanctuary cities specifically, but let's take a broader look at your work. Maybe you could give us a brief summary of what's currently causing emigration from Guatemala. Under what circumstances are people leaving? Where are they hoping to go? And where did they end up? I mean, we just talked about some of them ending up more in the East Bay, but you know what's bringing them where?
Well, let's start by remembering that San Francisco is a relatively small community of immigrants. If you compare it to Los Angeles and some of the other large cities, there's less in San Francisco. So that's just because it's a smaller population overall. And especially LA is definitely a target destination. In terms of where they go. Why do they come? Well, originally, I mean, the first really mass, our book includes a demographic study of the numbers of Guatemalans who came during different periods. The migration to the United States didn't really begin till the late 1970s in a massive way from Guatemala. And there was labor migration. There was always people looking to improve their situation, but it was basically a product of the Civil War, which particularly in the Mayan Highlands just led to a tremendous outflow of people. And so beginning in the, because there were genocidal policies that were being carried out in the Highlands. And so a tremendous number of the people who came to the United States and here were seeking asylum. They weren't called refugees because they didn't come in with refugee status. They came in going basically on foot or by bus through Mexico, which was a tremendous, difficult, long journey, and then coming in over the U.S. border. And, you know, it was definitely, they were fleeing state violence. It was basically that the war in Guatemala ended in 1996, but the migration increased. And we did actually, I participated in the study where we talked to, we interviewed 300 Guatemalans and Salvadorans here and in another 300 in Los Angeles and asked them, you know, why are you here and do you plan to go back now that the war is over? And the percentages across the board were in the 90s of people who did not expect to go back, and the reason was that the absence of war didn't solve the economic problems, right. And there were no jobs back there to go back to. Mm-hmm. So that was a major, it began to be more and more labor migration, combined with new situations that they were fleeing. Environmental catastrophes, Hurricane Mitch in 1998, and other floods, droughts, all of those kinds of conditions. And then the violence, the social violence that has replaced political violence in the post-war era. And that includes, in Guatemala, gangs is not the main sorts of that, as in El Salvador. In Guatemala, it's organized crime, drug rings, now infiltrated down from Mexico. And then, you know, a tremendous amount of violence and domestic violence. I think that it's very important to understand how many women leave to get out of situations that that they cannot they can't survive in.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing is that refugee centers and other legal support organizations have won tremendous victories in terms of being able to get domestic violence recognized as a cause and actually grant asylum to some of the victims.
Yeah.
So, but those have been hard-fought battles. And now, of course, there's the situation of Central Americans at the border, unaccompanied children and children with mothers who are being picked up by the Border Patrol. And they are, the unaccompanied children get better treatment in a certain respect. If they can find relatives while they're waiting to hear that case, they get released to the relatives. The mothers are being held in detention centers, especially in Texas, but those in just horrendous conditions. So the last thing I'd like to say is that family reunification is a major reason. Kids come looking for their parents who came earlier.
Mm-hmm. That paints an overall pretty grim picture of what people are escaping, and then in some cases what they end up finding here. You know, they come to escape violence, either domestic violence or organized crime, drug rings, no economic opportunity, no way to get out of it. And then they come here and they find themselves in a shattered community in some cases, or in detention centers. And yet San Francisco is considered a sanctuary city.
Right.
And what exactly does that mean?
Well, sanctuary city, let me say that there is no national definition, because these are local laws.
Uh-huh.
So each city defines sanctuary in its own way. The history of sanctuary city in San Francisco is that originally, in 1985, sanctuary was conceived of as a way of giving relief to Central Americans, specifically Salvadorans and Guatemalans.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1989, that was a board of supervisors and the mayor approved a law that basically guaranteed non-cooperation with the INS and the Immigration Naturalization Service that was doing raids and so on, and not handing over information to federal authorities.
Mm-hmm.
That was a major point of sanctuary. So if we fast forward from 1989 to the current period, some things have changed. One is that because of the Secure Communities program that has been implemented since 2008, let me just mention one major change, which is that the INS was incorporated into the Department of Homeland Security and invented, it became much larger and much more disciplined bureaucracy, and with a much more unified sense of that their goal was to do. This was in the post 9/11 period, and at that time immigrants were being conflated with terrorists, so that was the justification for border operations. And so in 2003, the Department of Homeland Security was formed, and they began immediately, they developed a program called Endgame, which was designed to deport all, at that time, 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants. Kind of what Donald Trump is saying today.
I was about to say, that sounds familiar.
Yes, it sounds very familiar now. Obviously, that's not possible. But they began some mass-scale deportation programs. And they tried it at workplaces, but when the stories of those got around, they had to stop that because they were so cruel in terms of the raids. So in 2008, the program called Secure Communities, ESCOM, became their main focus. And one of the things about ESCOM was that it requires all localities to turn over the names of any undocumented immigrants who are arrested, booked, charged with a crime, not convicted, but charged with a crime. There were attempts by San Francisco and a number of other places to opt out of that.
Because essentially that requires local law enforcement to hand over immigration information about an individual who may or may not have committed a crime as soon as they're arrested before there's any necessary proof that they did it.
Right, exactly. So there was pushback here and about 4 or 5 years later, the state passed the Trust Act, and San Francisco passed Due Process for All, which were meant to protect the due process rights of immigrants until such time as they had been convicted.
And did it work?
ESCOM was saying that you can't do that. Hmm. What worked was that there was one very specific phase of the detention and deportation process where ICE was asking local law enforcement communities to give them 48 extra hours to come and pick up people after their sentence was completed or to deport them. And the Trust Act and Due Process for All said, no, we're not going to do that. And 360 local jurisdictions refused to cooperate with that. Now, some people call them all sanctuary cities, and it's not exactly true. Sanctuary cities are those that have passed a sanctuary ordinance and called themselves that. But the rest are they're not fully cooperating with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau under DHS. And that is going on right now. And there's some question as to whether that's being recognized or not. At the moment, this is the kind of standoff that's going on. And this is the places that have passed local ordinances are not turning over the information, and it was not being enforced in a certain way until July 1st of this year.
Wow.
The Steinle killing on Pier 14 of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Thrust this all back into the public domain.
Yeah, certainly.
With Senator Feinstein, who's always been a hardliner on immigration issues, saying that she was going to sponsor a bill that would basically make it impossible for local jurisdictions to refuse to cooperate with ICE requests.
Also, like you said, presidential candidates and Senator Feinstein are coming out and saying things about this. Do you think it's an appropriate perspective or lens through which to examine immigration policy for an event, that an event like this happened?
Well, no, of course not.
I suppose that one was obvious.
No, but, it's what has happened.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think it's going to affect policy?
Well, I we'll see. We'll see. It, after the initial reactions where everybody was saying, oh, this is so tragic about the killing. It is. It was a tragic killing. I mean, and it may have been a tragic accidental tragedy. But this has been a tragedy for millions of immigrant families who are now under the spotlight again and the target of, you know, and the delayed and final executive actions that President Obama announced in November are now off the table. So that there's virtually no chance that the Obama administration will be able to help, to the extent that they delayed and delayed and delayed and finally did announce some measures that would help.
Mm-hmm.
Among the things that I think you were interested in is what can be done at the local or federal level to help immigration policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking of bad policy,
right.
What would be good policy?
Right. Locally, if they can stop Latino decline, they could help more immigrants. So I think that there's a little battle going on here in San Francisco. I mean, it's hard to reverse what's happened in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But at least it would stabilize where things are at now and not continue to go down. Federally, I think the first thing is not a law. It's an action, which is during this whole period of the 6 years of Obama's presidency, because of the systems that were already in place and their unwillingness to challenge those, a total of about 400,000 undocumented immigrants, mostly undocumented, have been deported each fiscal year since 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just massively more than before. And the Obama administration has been saying again and again, well, we're targeting criminals. But actually, some of them are misdemeanors, not felonies. Some of them are actually legal permanent residents who've gotten caught up in this. And the main thing is that, that these are... These are numbers that are quota-driven. It's like the ICE bureaucracy is challenging itself to carry this out. And the numbers of people who have been deported are not, it's not targeted to criminals because there was a study that was done to around 2010-11 by several law school units, which actually discovered that of those deported from the San Francisco and Alameda County, something like 70% were not felons.
Oh.
So over 70%.
Wow.
So.
Okay. So it sounds like more targeted enforcement, if any enforcement at all, would be useful.
Well, yeah, and to stop the mass deportations, including the people who are coming over the border. I mean, they're coming for reasons. They're not coming just in order to have babies in the United States. They're coming for very important reasons. And so stopping the mass deportations is something that can be done while we've got a president who is supposedly committed to turning things around a little bit. And so I would say that's the most important demand.
Great. Well, unless there's something else that you want to add, I'll just encourage everybody to come see you at 7 p.m. at Modern Times Books for the full version of this talk and more. And Suzanne, thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure.
This has been Listen Local, brought to you by Mission Local. After us, stick around for some electronic tunes and more from across the pond, brought to you by John Digital. Thanks for listening.